Okay. We'll go back on the stand. Mr. Sparvey, you're still under oath. Commissioner Fedorchak, did you want to question Mr. Sparvey some more?
I did have one additional question on the commitment to North Dakota Generation. This is just from a practical standpoint. When I look at how the gas, your fleet additions here for 2017 kind of transpired in your resource additions, and like you applied, you said, here's our plan, and then Minnesota said, now we got to do this competitive acquisition. So you went through that, and then they have picked something totally different. And the company kind of backed away from its original proposal, even in the competitive acquisition process, kind of backed away from its North Dakota Generation with Black Dog. The way I view the tool in the settlement agreement is it's a potential tool for the company to use in a situation like that, where you have sort of a whole plateful of kind of competitive, similar projects, and it sways you to say, but we're going to pick this one. And it gives you a tool to say to the Minnesota Commission or anybody else who's interested, we have to do this because of a North Dakota order. So it's sort of our way of exercising kind of our policy priorities, while Minnesota has a whole bunch of tools doing the same thing. Is that a correct way to kind of view that from a strategy standpoint?
I think so. I mean, I hear you saying it commits us to building generation here. It's similar to some commitments we've seen in other states, and I think to that extent there are a lot of similarities.
And it would probably be helpful as a way to persuade other jurisdictions that you have this is what you have to do. And so, sorry, Minnesota or whoever is saying you need to do something else, this is what we have to do because of this order, and this is why the company is pushing this project.
It does commit us to build here. We're intent on keeping that commitment. And as I offered earlier, certainly I'd support updates as to how we're doing. Mr. Wishart might testify, if you wish, on how we could implement that.
And I was very appreciative of the many caveats in the settlement agreement that emphasize that it needs to be, you know,
yes,
when demand is needed and as it's the most cost effective, and all of those considerations, which are just vital to good energy development rate making moving forward, and making sure that it's low cost and serves the customer as well. So, all right. Thank you. That was my final question.
Thank you. Commission counsel, Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Sparvey, I've got some questions. I'm going to try not to cover ground that you've already covered, but I've got some, I think, clarifications or make sure that I understand the testimony. And I'm going to start off first with what I think you described as the 1983 document, and I think you referred to it as kind of a cost-sharing agreement with Minnesota.
Yes, it's technically called an interchange agreement. The FERC staff would turn up their noses at something called cost sharing, but it has the effect of cost sharing. And I don't want to sound too precise as to the date. It's around that 83 time frame.
And my understanding of how you explained it was that was a way to regulate how NSP Wisconsin and NSP Minnesota bought power from each other to have it.
It's a way to determine how the costs are assigned, yes.
And you talked about there being a signatory to the 12CP at that time. Do you know if there was a study about whether 12CP was the appropriate demand allocator at that time, or if it was just an agreement that it would be the allocator?
Well, and let me say, I hoped I clarified that. Actually, the companies are the signatories, but the jurisdictions all bought off on that. I'm sure we did some studies. I don't have them in mind right now, but I remember several meetings of all the jurisdictions, and my recollection is they all brought information with them.
Okay, and is that information on the allocator, or is that information on more the purpose of the whole agreement? Do you know what I'm saying?
the information they brought dealt with how the plant should be allocated or assigned.
And as I understand it, the purpose of the study proposed in the settlement that we're here to address today is to gather information, all sorts of information, to make an informed decision on whether 12CP or some other allocator should be the appropriate method going forward.
Yes.
And that would, part of that would be, you know, maybe we need a different sort of allocation like Mr. Diller proposed, maybe a percentage considering many different options.
There are many options, yes.
And finding, and part of that would even be just finding out what information's out there to evaluate that issue and explore it and see how it would apply.
Yes, I agree.
Is the study, it's got a July 2014 date on it, but what do you see, the company see as the end result, the use of that study, some sort of document or work papers or what coming from the study?
Well, I think that, and some of this, of course, will depend on what staff would like to see, but I think there's the development of some baseline information with respect to relative costs of generation and use by hours. There's also with that, I think, a continuum of outcomes that look at all from a single hour a year or 1CP to looking at many hours or over the course of the year. So it's the development of both the information as well as the costs and then kind of stratified over time.
The next kind of area I want to talk to you about is this 5550, again, the rate increases, okay?
Yes.
You had, in your testimony, I think you'd mentioned the work papers in your discussion of how that, and I know those have been filed as trade secrets, so I don't necessarily want to get into the numbers right now in the open hearing, but what, how are the work papers used to support the 5550 increases?
How do the work papers support that?
Yeah, what's the relationship between the
work papers? Well, we've got work papers that support plant additions, and, of course, as we look out there at a higher level, but I believe that we have provided staff all the plant additions, especially by the early years, so that they can be evaluated and audited, and the commission can be assured that, in fact, our revenue requirement is based on what our operational costs have been.
If I was to sum up your testimony, and I just want to make sure I'm hearing it correctly, but Commissioner Kalk had asked you about 10% in the beginning, and Commissioner Christman had asked you about a lower percent spread out all the way. And thinking about that and what's proposed in the settlement, what I think heard you say was you're trying to match investments in revenue for the first 3 years and then basically have agreed as part of the trade-off in a settlement that in the fourth year we're just going to take zero. Is that
accurate? We'll take a zero rate increase, yes.
Okay. And was that part of the back and forth or, you know, I'm assuming it was...
Okay. Yes, yes.
Because I'm assuming there would be some sort of matching of revenue to costs in year 2016, also just that the companies agreed it would not ask for an increase in that year. As part of the settlement, it would not have an increase in rates for that year.
Yes, I mean, other than any potential impact of the riders, I mean, this settles the base rate case increase. There's things going both ways. You could see a change in the rate as a result of the generation stack going one way and the riders going the other way. I guess I don't have a good sense for how they might come out net right now, but our anticipated rate of return is definitely lower in that out year.
And then I did want to clarify one thing that Commissioner Kalk was asking you about, because you had said if we do 10% in year 2013, we would have, I think you said, a 0% return in the following years, but I think maybe there was a miscommunication there, because if you had 10% in 2013, that rate increase would carry across the later years. There would still be of return, correct?
I guess I was referring to the rate of the increase. I guess I'm sorry if I was confused.
So what you meant was there'd be 0% increase in the following years, not that you...
Well, I'm sorry. Also, just to explain why it is that matching is important. And if you took it to extreme and we were to earn multiple years of earnings in one year and none in another, why that, what sort of financial mismatch that creates.
So in other words, in 2013, a 10% rate increase wouldn't match with your increased costs.
That's correct. But I also want to come back and say I think Commissioner Christman had suggested, you know, taking a look at what we could do with interim rates, a potential interim rate refund, which is a good idea. I mean, if the commission wants us to come back and look at some kind of reshaping of that, we'll do it. We came to this as the what we thought was the best solution after a lot of back and forth. But if there's another pattern, we'll go back and look at it.
And I kind of wanted to come back around to being here on the settlement between advocacy staff and council. Mm-hmm. And I understand from looking at your resume, it's filed that you are an attorney, correct?
Yes, I am.
Could you explain maybe some of what you see as the benefits or things that can be done with this settlement that maybe can't be done in just deciding the straight rate case issues?
Well, this settlement, I think, involves a very comprehensive resolution of many issues that in some cases are difficult to decide individually. And it's really having the ability to I think, for us to weigh and evaluate the trade-offs of all of these in this universal agreement that make this such a rare opportunity. For example, to decide the or evaluate the impact of the generation restack without an understanding of what your rates may look like outside of that is difficult. And it's the look at the relative relationship of these issues that make us conclude that this is the best possible resolution and provides really a rare opportunity to do that.
I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Jeff Kotsako at this point.
Thank you, and I'm going to follow Mitch's question. That was even deeper. I thought I knew what he was asking, but that was a deeper answer. So let's go back to the simple version. Are there piece parts of the settlement that would not be able to typically be ordered or required in a typical rate order? And can you tick those off if there are any?
I guess I'm not familiar enough with the commission's authority to know without the force of this agreement whether they could exercise some of those things, ordering to build a plant, for example, and ordering some of the fuel clause reduction and the like. I'm not saying they don't have that authority. I'm just saying I'm not familiar enough to give you my opinion on
okay.
that.
Okay. I appreciate maybe it was unfair of me to try to ask that. But I do appreciate the previous answer, too, because I hadn't thought of that one. I have a couple questions on the commitment to build.
Yes.
I don't want to get into the legal analysis, but, you know, the sentence that I was reading in your testimony from page 10, the commitment is consistent with prudent resource planning requirements, and Commissioner Fedorchuk mentioned a few other sort of limitations on the commitment that that seem reasonable.
Yes.
But if the commission, if the company were to not fulfill its commitment and if the commission were to pursue a legal proceeding to force the commitment, as I understand it, there are factual issues that might be litigated in that proceeding, one of which would be whether the resource the commission is trying to make the company build is prudent. Is that correct?
There could be, yes.
Okay. Another one might be, as Commissioner Fedorchuk mentioned, is it needed?
Yes.
Okay. So the commitment is dependent on those factual bases existing in order for the company to fulfill its commitment. And the settlement recognizes that. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
So following that and moving to the restack?
Yes.
If I understand correctly, the restack applies only to the concept in the settlement, applies only to generation that would be paid for through the fuel adjustment, at least at this point in time. Is that correct? And not to generation that's already in rates. Base rates. And I'm asking because
well,
I'm not
I guess I'm trying to think that through because the cost of all generation flow through the fuel.
Well, the cost of fuel flows through the fuel clause.
Yes.
Okay.
It does.
But then, as I understand it, then the cost of other generation that isn't fuel flows through the fuel clause. And I have this question. Because let's say, for example, we were Minnesota and we didn't like nuclear, and you were going to restack your generation mix to exclude nuclear, when, in fact, nuclear might be, for sake of this question, the most prudent, reasonable, and efficient resource.
Yes.
I am trying to get to the bottom of how a company could promise such a thing and how a commission could approve such a thing. If all of those factual assumptions, you know, existed, I have a problem with the rate-making principle, and I need to know if the company sees the same problem. So if nuclear and coal and some of your base rate generation is part of this restacking,
yes,
I need to know the answer to that, even if North Dakota loves it at the moment. Sort of a long question, but I need to know first if it's all the resources or just these resources that go through the fuel adjustment.
My counsel is just going to hand it. The agreement says that talks about how we've allocated resources in the past and talks about the North Dakota objective.
And what page are you on in the agreement? So
page
people can
14.
Find. Page what?
Page 14.
Okay. I'm going to take a minute and get to it.
I could also suggest Mr. Cedarquist or Mr. Wishart, who are also very familiar with this provision, can also answer these questions. But please go ahead.
Okay. I will ask them some questions,
yes.
But I would like to ask you one rate-making theory question because I know you're probably the expert on that. I struggle with how – not so much with how a company could restack and choose to charge a jurisdiction,
yes,
a certain dollar figure, because I think you probably are entitled to do whatever you want, whether it's smart, dumb, bad, good, or whatever. But how could a commission approve the charging of its ratepayers for a made-up generation mix that may not be the most prudent, reasonable, least-cost resource?
I think this process is carefully designed to get you a prudent resource. I mean, it certainly identifies principles, all of which are well accepted, and provides the basis for the resource selection process. And I think results in a mix that's very consistent with the state's policy objective. So I guess I see the basis for deriving a reasonable rate from that component to be very defensible.
Okay, so if the parties stick to the principles in the settlement,
yes,
and if the commission holds them to that promise, yes, in your opinion, it should,
yes,
it should not have the effect of coming up with an unreasonable,
yes,
resource mix.
Yes.
What you're,
yes,
saying? Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
Mr. Norrell, any more questions for Mr. Sparb?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Simpson or Ms. Valley?
Thank you. I just have a few follow-up,
sure,
questions from the conversation today. Previously, in your discussions with Commissioner Fedorchuk, you had referenced your investment in plant.
Yes.
Is that limited to just generation?
No, I guess I'm applying an accounting point of view to that. I meant to suggest any utility property. It could be generation or it could be transmission. I think of it in terms of utility plant, and I apologize if I'm too general in that regard.
Do you remember what that was, what line of questioning that was part of? I'd like to reconnect it.
No, I apologize. I can't remember the direct question. Now, much of the discussion today has centered on the multi-year rate plan,
yes,
component of the agreement. And you've indicated in your discussions today that the company is willing to look at some additional alternatives that have been raised. Is that correct?
Yes, we are.
One issue that might be helpful as we go through the course of the day, though, is how you got to the plan that you are at today. And do you have the testimony, supplemental testimony of Dave Cedarquist in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And I would point you to page 17, where the company, where Mr. Cedarquist begins discussing about the different options and the multi-year rate plan.
Mm-hmm.
The plan proposed is the 5550 plan, and was the intent of that to match costs and revenues over the multi-year?
Yes, that was the intent.
And does this plan reflect a balance of risks to the company and to the customers that ultimately results in customers receiving the benefit of any over-earnings, but the company taking on any under-earnings? And does the company under this plan predict an under-earning in 2016?
Yes, we do.
And I would please turn to page 18. Okay, yeah. And under this scenario, the company reviewed a percentage increase of 3.75 per year. Is that correct?
Yes.
And can you explain why this approach is less desirable than the 5550 approach?
Well, the resulting returns are for us considerably less desirable. I mean, obviously the earned return differs from the authorized return significantly under this plan.
And Mr. Sparby, on page 19, you have also evaluated another proposal, which includes more front loading of the rate increase.
Yes.
And can you please explain why that is a less desirable outcome for your customers?
Well, there's really
the 5550.
First of all, it's a much more volatile pattern for customers. Customers who are on the system in 2014 are obviously going to pay more than their cost of service relative to customers in 2016. does not match our cost and revenue pattern well. And also, of course, this staff was intent on over-earning sharing, and we'd have to revise the settlement agreement in that regard. Finally, I'll just say in terms of predictability for customers, introduces less of that. But at the same time, I want to say once again, you know, if you'd like us to go back and think about something with interim rates or other things or reshaping this differently, we'll do it.
And Mr. Sparby, Commissioner Christman had raised the prospect of whether you could utilize the interim rate refund as some offset to rates. And if that were the case, are there some accounting treatments that you're aware of that would be necessary, such as a deferral order?
Yes, we would have to seek additional authority.
I mean, Mr. Sparby, I only have one question. I think a big part of this settlement really reflects a several-year look at both the system and the way the company does business.
Yes.
And if there was no multi-year rate outcome as part of the settlement, that doesn't eliminate the need for additional revenue for the company during its investment cycle. Is that correct?
No, the fact of the investment pattern of the next few years is we would be in for a rate case every year.
And does the multi-year aspect of the settlement provide an opportunity for the company to implement a lot of the policy-driven issues, such that by putting a multi-year rate plan in place, you can address a lot of the other concerns that have been raised here in an orderly fashion?
Yes, it does. It's a very rare opportunity for a comprehensive settlement of many issues before the commission, and that's why I extend my thanks to staff to bring this opportunity to our attention and to move us closer to implementing a North Dakota energy policy. It's a rare opportunity to do this.
I have nothing further.
Commissioners, any more questions for this witness?
And for me.
Mr. Sparby, you may step down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
Mr. Simpson. Next witness.
Will the company calls Mr. Dave Sparby? I'm sorry, Mr. Dave Cedarquist.
Team
today. We were just having so much fun.
I know you've been chomping at the bit to get up here and take this oath.
Get in trouble.
Ms. Cedarquist, you heard the perjury admonition at the beginning of Mr. Sparby's testimony, so please raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Sally.
Mr. Cedarquist, your supplemental testimony in this case has been stipulated into the record. Do you have any corrections to that testimony today?
I do have one small correction here. Let me see if I can find it here. On page 24, there's a chart. The footnote provides the source of the data, and in the footnote, in parentheses, it says all customer classes. This chart's really focused on residential. I just want to make that clear.
Thank you, Mr. Cedarquist. And do you have an opening statement today?
I do.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Kalk and Commissioners Christman, Commissioner Fedorchik. I'm really pleased to be here today and have the opportunity to support the settlement. As you know by now, this is a pretty unique settlement. I believe that the issues that it addresses and the ways in which it does so are really quite unprecedented, certainly here in North Dakota. And it's also remarkably comprehensive. It addresses a wide array of policy and financial and reporting issues that have come out of this case, but also prior dockets and seven other open cases that are pending before you. Why do I believe the settlement should be approved? Quite frankly, because of what it accomplishes. It's really like a very big honey-do list with all the items checked off. First of all, it addresses cost recovery, not for a single test year, but for a four-year period, which bridges the company's current investment cycle. You've heard us say that many times. The rate adjustments were designed with several goals in mind, and this is the important aspect when we talk about why did we land on what we landed on. But these goals are to provide more rate stability and predictability, minimize the customer impact on bills, reduce the frequency of rate filings and their attendant costs, and offer a chance for the company to earn a reasonable return on its investment each year of the four-year term. The settlement responds directly to the Commission's desire to create a path for approving an Xcel Energy resource mix that matches the North Dakota priorities. Regardless of the mandates or requirements that are in place in other states we serve, North Dakota regulators would have a framework to set lower rates reflecting generating resources that, in your view, best meet our customers' needs at least cost or as otherwise dictated by North Dakota policy. Commissioner Kalk, it would be great to have you visit Ben and Dave and Laura, but this settlement does resolve many of your issues. With this settlement, the company will begin formally planning its first thermal generating plant in North Dakota to meet a future capacity need. And in doing so, Xcel Energy will achieve greater geographic diversity for its dispatchable generating fleet, and it will enhance reliability in the areas of North Dakota that we do serve. While our commitment time frame does extend 20 years out, we believe that fulfillment of this objective could be achieved much sooner than that. And with respect to the most significant allocator of system costs to North Dakota, the settlement calls for the first separate North Dakota proceeding to study demand allocation, a focus on it. It will likely be the most thorough as well in terms of both the technical analysis and the level of participation by perhaps regulatory personnel from other states, perhaps other utilities, and perhaps even other third-party consultants, whoever we deem should be at the table. These landmark actions and reforms are by themselves fairly dramatic, but the settlement accomplishes much more. It reduces by over $1 million the number of selected test year expenses. It resolves pending ADPs and cost recovery for 5 natural gas and wind generating facilities, 3 of which are proposed to be located in North Dakota. It requires commission notification when new power contracts are included in our fuel cost rider. It establishes 2 rider tariffs to enable timely cost recovery of future transmission infrastructure and North Dakota wind generation that we will own. The settlement calls for development of a meaningful residential time of day rate that could lower North Dakota energy demand and ultimately customer bills. It requires the company to pursue reforms for selling renewable energy credits to expedite and increase the proceeds that could be credited to North Dakota customers. It expands the reliability improvement initiatives we began in 2012. And finally, it requires improved jurisdictional financial updating of data and reporting and more understandable electric rate book. The North Dakota Commission does have a strong history of regulatory innovation. I've been fortunate to experience that, see that firsthand, and I know that it's motivated principally by an emphasis on results and getting to those results with limited resources. I've had the pleasure of working with the Commission and staff for 20 years, and I sincerely mean that. I think I had more hair, though, 20 years ago. But I know that whether it's performance-based regulation or fixed monthly gas charges or earnings sharing mechanisms or revenue true-ups or formula rate caps, even pre-discovery phase rate settlements, this commission has done it and done it successfully. So there's a lot of progress just ready to be made here that would not otherwise be possible without this settlement. As Commissioner Kalk has alluded to, it's time to get going. And with your approval, we can get these initiatives underway for the benefit of our North Dakota customers and our other stakeholders. So Thank you, and I'd be happy to address any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you. This witness is available for examination.
Okay. Mr. Norrell.
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Cedarquist, thank you for your opening. I know it focused a lot on the benefits of the settlement. What do you see as any potential risks for the settlement, the uncertainties that could be cause a negative impact?
Well, there are certainly risks for the company. We are agreeing to a number of significant changes that we hope will improve service in the future in the state. But, you know, we're agreeing to a series of fixed rate increases. And as Mr. Sparby alluded to, we need to manage within those. 2016 is a risk for us. We do not have an increase in that year. And I guess I can characterize that a couple of ways. First of all, the rate freeze in 2016 is a recognition that what was being proposed the first 3 years is a stretch. I mean, it's new. It's something that we knew there might be some uncomfortableness with. Secondly, the 2016 also puts the onus on us to remedy the issue around the restack. We have several million dollars at risk there if we can get recovery for what is restacked out of North Dakota in other jurisdictions. We can be okay in 2016. So that's another reason why there's really not a built-in increase in 2016, but we're on the hook for that. And, you know, it shows our financial projections are low in that year because of it. But
you touched on it a little bit in your answer, but I want to focus the question a little more on it. Why is, in your opinion, the rate increase of 5%, 5%, 5%, 0% the best or most appropriate way to go, whichever way you want to phrase it?
Well, we did have a lot of discussion about the proper way to approach rate recovery. And I guess I'll just maybe preface my comments by saying the investment plan that we've talked about in the informal and that Mr. Sparby has referred to is a very real investment plan. It's very significant. We're building these plants. We're repowering plants. We're refurbishing. We're extending the lives of these plants because we have thousands of customers depending on us, and we do not have the luxury to wait until the last minute. We need to make these expenditures to our grid so that we can reliably generate the power and deliver it to our customers. They're real dollars. They will happen, and they will drive costs. So the key issue becomes, how do we take that series of costs and how do we recover those from customers in a way that virtually minimizes the impact? I mean, there is going to be an impact. We're not talking about eliminating the impact. We're talking about how do we make that as easy as we possibly can for customers and yet still keep the company financially healthy. So what we do, first of all, is we agree to the ROE, and we did agree to the lowest ROE I think that's ever been or that ever would be approved if this settlement is approved, 9.75 for the starting year. Staff did agree to bump that up in the ensuing years, probably out of recognition of the long-term risk there. Once we agreed to that, then we needed to refine our long-term forecast. We needed to not look at a single year. We needed to go out and revisit our five-year forecast, which, if you'll recall, part of the settlement, the delay in the settlement, was to making sure that we had fully vetted that forecast because we knew the importance. Now, there's absolutely no incentive for us to have a forecast that's not good, that's overstated. I've been around this business long enough to know that this commission gets the last word on everything. So we're very motivated and incented to make sure that that forecast was accurate. And, you know, quite frankly, we have probably more risk with that forecast than our customers do. We're going to share half of anything that would ever go over the authorized return, and we have no recourse if we under-earn. And as I mentioned before, those increases are fixed. So we take a look at that forecast and we go, okay, Now we want to minimize the impacts, and we want to provide some rate predictability. We don't really want to have 10% in 1 year and nothing the next year and 5% the next year. We want this to be very easy to remember, very predictable. We have a number of customers who really value knowing what the rates are going to be in the next year or two. They call us and they ask us what's going to happen. So we wanted that to be very predictable. Another goal is that we wanted to be able to provide the opportunity for the company to earn its authorized. Commissioner Fedorchik, we've heard you mention, what can we do to help the company realize its authorized earnings each year? Well, this is the method that most closely allows us to get to that agreed-to ROE. We wanted to make sure that the implementation would be simple, relatively simple. So we weren't interested in a lot of deferrals and refunds and back and forth, and we wanted to keep this as simple as possible. So we've minimized that with this 5550 plan. So those are the goals that we kind of that guided us through the selection of the 5550.
Does this settlement take you through the rate increases as a result of what you've termed your current investment cycle?
I would use the term that the revenue streams would be minimally sufficient. We think we can get close in those first 3 years. And 2016, we have a lot of work to do to get there.
But, and thank you for that, but kind of the purpose of my question, I maybe didn't ask it right, was we've heard a lot of talk about the current investment cycle and all the costs with the rate increases. And this settlement is intended to stop the consistent rate increase application. So it says the company cannot apply again in 2017. Does this settlement address at least most of that current investment cycle, or would it be expected in 2017 that, or the next rate application, that this investment cycle that's talked about is still in, continuing in that the next rate case, if you will?
Our company capital expenditures do significantly drop off in 2016. Obviously, they don't go away, but we are in an elevated mode right now, and they clearly drop off. So what I could envision after this, some of you may recall that in the early 2000s, we actually had a five-year performance-based plan, which worked well on more of a maintenance level from a rate maintenance standpoint. It wouldn't necessarily accommodate large investments, but you could see coming out of this agreement some potential for a performance-based type framework going forward that would require the company to meet certain performance targets and possibly be in a position to get some rate relief if it's needed on a minimal basis. So that's just one thought. We certainly hope that, when we get through this investment cycle, that there won't be the frequency of rate cases, that we can stay out even longer, than the 2017 time period. But that's a long ways out, too. Let's not forget. That's out there a ways. So,
in talking about the current investment cycle, I know Mr. Sparby had said a lot of it was updating plant and things that had been built in the 1960s and 70s, but it's fair to say also the investment cycle is somewhat driven by energy policies throughout the jurisdictions that Xcel does business, isn't it? Such as renewable policies.
My thought on that is not really. If I look at, for example, the Renewable Energy Standard in Minnesota, we have met most of that through purchase contracts. Granted, we do own a couple farms. So those costs, run through the fuel cost rider. They don't create a lot of investment for us. The recent slate of wind projects that we are working on right now, the 750 megawatts, we will own at least two of those projects. But those projects are, as Mr. Sparby referred to, those were opportunities to reduce costs net-net for customers. So a little bit different maybe perhaps than earlier efforts to meet that RES. So I don't know that the investment is driven by mandates in other states.
Can you give me the plain English version of what the REST Act does?
The REST Act gives North Dakota what they've been asking for. It should be a favorable arrangement for the commission because they shouldn't really have to worry about what other states want to do in terms of energy policy. We are agreeing to work with the staff to develop a framework that would allow us, when we file for rates in North Dakota, to reflect what would have occurred under North Dakota policy for resource selection, not what would have occurred as a result of another state's mandates or requirements. So I guess that's about the easiest way I can say it.
If this is approved, do you know what or if or how the company has to react to that in its other jurisdictions?
I don't know fully all the ramifications or communication that we'll need to have. I would anticipate, however, that once the REST Act framework is formalized and we can see what the results are in North Dakota and we understand which types of resources we're perhaps no longer recovering fully here, that we'll have to approach, in particular Minnesota. Most of these projects, do stem from mandates there, and lay it out there and make a case for, you know, recovery from Minnesota retail customers for those costs.
And if Minnesota wouldn't allow that type of recovery, am I correct in interpreting the settlement agreement that the company can't then come seek further recovery of that from North Dakota customers?
Yeah, that would really defeat the purpose of the whole process.
Yeah. I thought so. Just wanted to make sure. Page 8 of your testimony, you're talking a little bit about the REST Act. You had indicated it's on lines 20 through 23 of your testimony that the REST Act is expected to lower North Dakota rates in the near term by at least several million dollars beginning as early as 2016. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'm trying to convey the magnitude of this provision in the settlement, but I'm also being a little cagey at the same time because it's difficult to know before July of 2015 how this is all going to shake out. But there is a provision in the settlement, as the commission's probably aware, that if we can't get to a framework, we can't get it done, that there is sort of an automatic restack that occurs based on discussions we've already had and analysis that's already been done on our resource mix. And that particular automatic restack, we're costing out to be between $5 and $6 million. So I would envision that the final product might be somewhere in that neighborhood.
And I guess kind of my question when I was looking at that is, how likely is it to lower rates, and what's the likely amount, and what's the near term? Can you kind of give us what you
expect? For the REST Act?
Yeah.
Well, I think that we probably are looking at 2016 as an effective date for the final product. I mean, our goal is to have a have a framework filed, and we would assume that within 6 months the commission could approve it. Now, if they have take issue with it, you know, that could cause a delay. But, you know, after January 1, 2016, we're ready to implement it as soon as it can be implemented.
Okay, so I understand what you mean. So when you said near term, you were saying it would be by 2016. I was thinking it would. What you were saying was 2016, and for a short while after that.
Oh no, this is this would go on for as long as we think it can. You know.
Thank you. That answered my question.
You know, the restack, I might add, the restack kind of looks at what's existing, but it also, we intend on that framework to address future issues.
Is that, when I was looking at page 27 of your testimony, the last paragraph, again talking about the restack, and where you discuss that it will result in immediate cost savings, at least in the immediate future, are we talking about something different than what we were just discussing? What is this?
That's a reference to this two-sided nature of restacking the resource. You know, there are benefits and there are risks, and it would appear that in the near term there would appear to be benefits in terms of price, but of course, depending on how the industry changes, how natural gas prices change, as many other different things, you know, there's the potential that the commission might be giving up on the hedging qualities of some of these contracts. So that's what that's a reference to. As we know that in the short term there'd be rate reductions or bill reductions, but not necessarily in the long term.
When in the restack itself is kind of shaped on what I think you've determined it, or everybody's called North Dakota energy policies, those can also change over time, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
So as those change and evolve, how would you anticipate this restack to change and evolve?
Those changed preferences would change prospectively, just like any other policy change.
So as I'm gathering, the restack would be in effect till the next rate case, and then it could be evaluated again during the next proceeding.
Well, I guess maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I would expect that the framework would be set and would accommodate policy changes so that if, let's say, 20 years from now, a commission says, you know, we really want more wind, then that would be reflected in the next rate process. And if the company is adding wind, North Dakota would gladly pay a portion of that and have the wind serve North Dakota customers. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't see a future commission going, whoa, time out. You know, they really screwed up 20 years ago. Let's restack everything all over again. So
that's, I guess, kind of the purpose of my question was how long this restack would be effective and how it would work. So thank you. One of the things we dealt with in the ADPs that are part of this settlement is the desire from advocacy staff to have generation based in North Dakota, thermal generation, and the kind of competing principle of the company having to go through the Minnesota competitive acquisition process. You're familiar with that interplay, correct? Mm-hmm. In the settlement, there's been a commitment to basically, if it's prudent, build some generation in North Dakota by 2036. And during the ADPs, I don't recall which witness it was, but they basically, I thought, testified they could not build that generation if it didn't get approved by through the Minnesota competitive acquisition process. Is that your recollection? I know you were here for the hearings, or your understanding of how it has to work, at least as how the law is now?
Well, I can tell you how I understand the settlement to work and to address that issue.
Well, that's really what I'm getting at is there's this commitment that it may be, you know, if it's prudent to build it, there's also this prior history of testimony that we can't build it if it's not approved. And there were some small differences in the numbers in what got approved. So how do you anticipate the settlement working with the Minnesota capital acquisition process?
I think that could potentially be another risk item for us in the settlement, because what the settlement's saying is, in an upcoming capacity need, and there may be more than one in the next 20 years, if we have clearly demonstrated that a North Dakota plant is the least cost option and we don't follow through with it, or if through the CAP process we're ordered to do another alternative, then that's just, then we're not following the settlement. We've gone back on the settlement. So it's on us to make sure that if it is the least cost option, that the plant gets built before 2036.
That brings me back a little bit to the ADP proceedings, because we were talking about some of the non-monetary benefits of having local generation, and there were some relatively small differences between what was being promoted versus the Hankinson or Red River Valley 1 unit. And I think what the commission was asking or kind of hoping in some of the questionings was that the company maybe would push harder for this North Dakota generation given the relatively small dollar difference. Do you understand? And is that what's trying to be addressed in this settlement, of kind of forcing the company to push harder for North Dakota generation or to comply with the order?
I think you've nailed it right on the head. I mean, this settlement means we push harder. My understanding is that in our planning criteria, we will more formally integrate the value of the reliability into the assessment of the plant. So we'll give value to that. So, and the geographic diversity, we're going to work harder to show that the plant is the best option.
Going back to those ADP proceedings, I know that at that time, I'm talking about the gas ADPs, the Black Dog and the Red River Valleys. At that time, during that hearing, there was, I think the Red River Valley was third on the list of what was being pushed at or sought, and there was an Invenergy, and then I'm forgetting the name of the other one. But as I understand how that proceeding shook out, at least initially, was the administrative law judge said, nah, go with the solar, something to that effect. What's your understanding of where that stands?
I would probably defer answering that to Mr. Wishart. I haven't followed it closely. I'm aware that of the ALJ's recommendation, but beyond that, I don't know that I would be able to answer that very well.
And maybe it's not entirely relevant, but at least as far as this settlement goes, the company's position is, look, we'll push hard in North Dakota. We bear risks if we can't get it through the CAP process of this commission taking whatever enforcement provisions it may have against us if we can't get the generation built. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important element with the commitment is that, and I think Mr. Diller talks about this in his testimony, I mean, I don't think the North Dakota Commission wants a plant built by 2036 that isn't economic or that is just this gift plant to North Dakota. I think that so providing the 20-year time frame gives us enough time to not only, you know, develop a least cost option in North Dakota, but also to look at, you know, where should it be located, mm-hmm. and what will the gas supply look like in 10 years versus today, or even 15 years. Where you know, there's probably a better place to put a plant. And the economics could very well change. So that's why we don't just want to flat out say there will be a plant here regardless of some of those economics. So
and I understand. I mean, you don't build it just to have it. I mean, mm-hmm. there's got to be a need, and it's got to be prudent and reasonable and all of that. And that's what's built into the settlement. But those aren't necessarily the considerations given or the only considerations given when the project would be reviewed in the Minnesota capital acquisition process.
Right. The onus is on us to get it through that process. And I might just add to the backstop that the commission would still have is the restack framework that should be in place by then too. So if there's absolutely no way that plant can get built here and some other less optimal resources being selected or whatever, that also then could lend itself to application to the restack.
And agree, disagree, or don't even answer, but the point of my question being it's not just a sufficient excuse to not build generation to say, oh, it didn't get approved by Minnesota CAP process.
I would agree.
Thank you. That's all I have.
It's Jeff Kotsako.
Dave, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the restack, especially in light of this whole conversation, because I see all the same issues of prudence and reasonableness and everything with this restack. And Mr. Sparby referred to you when I was asking him some of these questions. So why don't you just walk me through, if you would, the restack plan, proposal, whatever you want to call it, and how it fits rate-making principles that we're obligated to comply with.
Mm-hmm. I will do that. And before I do that, I will also again suggest that Mr. Wishart perhaps answer some of the particular restacking kinds of things that could happen. You know, your question sort of shows why we've given ourselves a year and a half to work this through. I mean, it's complex, quite frankly, and we're going to need some time to talk about some of these issues. I've never been one to shy too far away from accounting kinds of limitations and things like that. So I'm not at all concerned by the fact that what we would be doing certainly today affects the fuel cost rider, but may in the future affect how base rates are developed.
Okay.
So that I'm not closing the door on that, if that was one of your concerns earlier.
But it's not affecting it today.
Right.
It might in some future case, rate case.
Right. My understanding is that even the automatic restack that would occur if we didn't come to an agreement is, I'm pretty sure it's pretty much all purchase contract related. Subject to check, I guess I would have to revisit that, but we've kept it fairly straightforward and simple. Now, the process and the guidelines that we've established in the settlement, you know, they're there to guide us through that discussion about how do we determine a replacement price for a resource that's being rejected.
I'm going to interrupt and ask a question before that.
Okay.
And how could you reject a resource if it's truly least cost, most efficient, most prudent, reasonable resource? How? I guess, again, the company can ask to have recovery on whatever it wants, but how could a commission bless rejecting that?
I'm having a hard time trying to envision why the least cost options would be rejected, so I don't think that would ever happen.
But I don't know that that's clear. I mean, I've read the settlement and the testimony now. I didn't see it blatantly in there. Maybe it has to be more blatant for me. I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question.
I suppose that there could be other considerations, such as the effect of intermittent resources on the system that could create a basis for wanting to, you know, reprice that with a different option because the commission is not comfortable with that approach. I suppose there are other things than price, but I would generally think, and certainly the staff has indicated it thus far in our settlement, you know, there's a certain level of reasonableness here that we're hoping permeates our discussions and the development of that framework. So, but it's still a good question. I mean, that's something that, you know, we'd have to address that when we get to it. But
I guess my problem here with this part of it is, if you have prudent, reasonable, least cost efficient resources that you're asking North Dakota to pay for, there's nothing to restack.
Correct.
And if you are saying, oh, we're going to restack it to conform to North Dakota policy, whatever that is, then you're implying that in order to make, you know, to satisfy commissioners or other policymakers, we will include something that isn't prudent, or, you know, we will take something out that is prudent and least cost and put something in that isn't prudent and least cost. Otherwise, why would you restack anything?
Well, I think the assumption is that what's prudent in one state may not be prudent in another state, or what needs to be complied with in one state may not be considered prudent in another state. So the restack recognizes those differences and says, if you don't think that this resource is prudent, then we would reprice that energy using what would have been the prudent alternative in the eyes of this commission.
Except for an integrated system, those answers should be the same from both states in a perfect world.
There you go. Yeah.
In the last case,
and
that's closed.
For
and done, and
decades, that's the way we operated. All the commissions generally agreed on the resource decisions, but we've seen in the last, you know, 10, 20 years a real divergence there, and it's a problem, and it needs to be resolved. And the settlement directly faces that problem, which, by the way, does sort of color every regulatory filing we make here. It becomes part of the issue, and we're attempting to resolve this huge problem. But we do need time to do that too as well. So,
okay, and here's something else I didn't see and might be in there. To face that problem head on, does the restack directly or maybe impliedly result in not having an ADP filing for every purchase that comes down the pike?
I hadn't thought of that.
Maybe.
I don't know. I would want to think about that a little more before responding.
Well, that is a question, I think, for both parties that would maybe you can talk about it a little bit and see if that's something you want to add to that. I did have one question that a request for some information that Jerry has asked for, and could the company provide, please, a late-filed exhibit with current or updated, if necessary, costs that would be coming through the transmission rider, so that we have more accurate, more up-to-date information for that?
Yes, I think we can provide that.
He's corrected me. He wants to know what's in the test year related to the I thought he wanted the current, but he wants to know what's in the test year for the transmission rider.
And if we're talking about the originally filed test year?
Jerry?
Whatever the settlement test year
Okay. The settlement, the figures that were part of our forecast, essentially.
Yes, with your permission,
Judge. Yes, you may.
I'd like to know what's in the settlement for transmission expenses already on the projects that we have going on out there right now. There's CapEx, and then there's MISO Schedule 26 charges and stuff like that. So if we could get the whatever the level is that we've got included in the settlement package already.
Okay.
Clarify, Jerry, is that
what we would include in the TCR or what's in base rates for the 13 test year?
I want to be able to look at this and the TCR together to see how much of the total expenses are being recovered where. So we're looking at QIP and stuff like that right now.
Thank you. And that's all the questions I have, except to give that late filed exhibit a number, please.
I think we were at 38 or 39. But and we've already had one. We were at NSB 38 was corrections to filed testimony. Late filed exhibits, you want to use a different numbering system?
Thank you, Your Honor. And for the exhibits that we've had in the rate case hearing, we did label them with a letter, and I believe the last one was P, so we could go to Q.
Well, we also have already talked about a late filed exhibit, which was going to be the 1983 five-state mm-hmm. comprehensive settlement. Sure. Do we want to assign that a letter as well?
Sure. We can certainly call that S, Q, or R.
And so this one will be P, is that correct?
Q for this, the request by Mr. Lean, and then I believe we could assign S to the agreement that was requested. Or R, excuse me, thank you.
R and Q, okay.
Your Honor.
Everybody's got that?
Your Honor, I do kind of a matter of order now that we're talking about exhibits. Yep. We had the conference yesterday on stipulated exhibits for today. We didn't address it all at the beginning of the hearing, but was it from yesterday's hearing that the pre-filed testimony, all of that is just entered, or should we handle that?
I think we should probably handle that for the record. My understanding was that we were going to be adding NSP 23 through 38. There was a stipulation to that yesterday. They are on the exhibit list that was presented today. There were no objections yesterday.
And, Your Honor, my understanding was it was going to be NSP 39 through NSP 44.
Okay, those are already stipulated.
Okay.
So when I'm looking at the exhibit list, there's an NSP 23 through 38. Have those been admitted?
Yes.
Okay.
And then for purposes of today's hearing, I understand the exhibits were NSP 39 through NSP 44. And PSC 23 through PSC 25 that the parties and commission counsel agreed to stipulate to the entry today.
Those were stipulated to yesterday at the pre-hearing conference, and they will be received. And the exhibit list already indicates that those documents have been stipulated.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up. Okay, I want to go now, I think, to questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
I'll just stick with the restack since that's where we left off with Alana. And I don't want to belabor this because I realize there's a lot that just needs to be developed and then we can analyze it and see how it looks. But since it is one of the key provisions that you and advocacy staff think are one of the benefits of this, I want to dig it, make sure I fully understand some of these things. So, I think what would be helpful for me is on, if you went to page 27 of your testimony, Dave, starting on line 24, where you talk about the restack will first adjust costs based on a current resource mix serving North Dakota customers as if it had been historically developed. So can you just make up, like on the fly, just some example of this, like create a little proxy resource mix and tell us how this would work.
I'll try to do that. I think that in our discussions, we, for example, we're looking at all of NSP's generating resources, the stuff we own, the contracts that we have, and it's fairly apparent that the legacy plants, the baseload plants, nuclear, Prairie Island, Monticello, the large coal plants. We have Sherco units 1, 2, and 3, King plant, some of those well-run legacy plants that have had good operating records, that we all agree that those were wise generating resources to build and to select, and so those kind of become accepted under the normal, usual allocation processes. And again, that the allocation process is another issue here, but those would fall under that. Then, you really start, then you look at the, for example, the renewable policies of each state. One state has a goal of 10%. One state has a mandate of 30%. And so you go, okay, well, we want to meet the goal, right? Yeah, we want to meet the goal in North Dakota. So what would comprise the 10%? What projects would do that? So I think, we haven't done this yet, but I'm going to envision what I can see happening. But we go back in time, and we look at the wind that's been added, and we look at why that wind was added, and we look at what kind of price that wind was added at, and we just kind of take a view of those wind selections and try to be as realistic as possible about what would fit the North Dakota thinking or preference around wind to meet the 10%. And that's not going to be easy, and there's going to be a lot of subjectivity around that, but we're going to have to agree on something. And so we do that, and what doesn't make that list presumably starts getting put on the out list, the restack out. There may be other types of plants or contracts that aren't wind. Well, I guess another thing is we have refuse-derived fuel plants, which burn garbage and create energy. So, I mean, I guess nothing is off the board. We look at everything and kind of try to make a decision about how that fits the North Dakota policy framework. But, yeah, when you start getting to the renewables and some of the newer things, the solar, some of the biomass, I mean, that's really where the rubber will hit the road, and we'll have to come to some agreement, again, guided by the principles in the settlement as to what would North Dakota have done under a different set of circumstances if they would have been calling the shots, more or less. How would that have affected our resource mix? So you design your own mix based on that basis, and then we determine how that would translate into rates
moving forward.
And now I've already mentioned that the current projects that we have looked at primarily are purchase power agreements, so they're cleanly running through the fuel cost rider, so it's relatively easy to identify them and reprice them at what would have replaced them, or what would have been selected in their stead. So, generally speaking, there's looking at the market at some LMP price. In the case of one of the biomass projects that you read about in the settlement, we would reprice at it using our King coal plant because the biomass contract is more of a baseload kind of plants running all the time. So we would use, what makes sense for that plant. And if there's a capacity piece and an energy piece, then we need to reprice both pieces. You can't just look at one. You have to kind of figure out, well, what would it have been? What would the capacity price be under this scenario?
I might be oversimplifying this, but would you be basically coming up with a price that would be sort of the acceptable price for baseload, an acceptable price for renewables, acceptable price for peakers, and then applying that
across the board? I'd have to go beyond just saying acceptable to it would be what would the other viable option be to meet the need that that we're trying to meet here. So okay. what presents itself, or presented itself, if we're going back in time, but what presents itself as the viable alternative is probably a better way to view it, mm-hmm. not just some general, you know, how much does coal cost? It would be, no, how much would it be to either, you know, build a coal plant, or, you know, that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then...
situational as possible.
Okay. So then I'm, again, probably oversimplifying here, but if I'm kind of reading between the lines of the clause that exists, if there can't be an agreement reached, all of these in the settlement agreement on attachment E, all the identified renewable PPAs on page 1 and the identified biomass PPAs on page 2, since those would be the ones that would be automatically kicked out, I'm kind of assuming that those are the ones that we approved over the years that maybe don't fall within the North Dakota energy policy, perceived policy standard, and maybe, dare I say, aren't that prudent?
I think you can dare say that from your perspective.
Right. I wasn't here then. I wasn't involved in this, so I'm just looking backwards in time thinking maybe they were approved. But
again, I mean, if you've got to comply with a requirement, it's prudent to comply with the requirement. So prudent in one sense may not be prudent mm-hmm. in the mind of the North Dakota Commission.
I'm writing down a question for Mike Diller because I'm going to ask him the next question that I came to mind, not you, because it's more appropriate for him. Okay. All righty. I think that's it for those questions on the resource mix, the restack. One other question on that. Since you mentioned, when I originally read this, I saw kind of the risk, the natural risk of committing to this, and then over time, different factors come on board, making our original desire to have all the fossil fuel generation, et cetera, and not maybe as much renewable. Over time, that doesn't work out because of federal regulatory changes, et cetera. But then you told Mitch that it's flexible, so this is going to change over time, or there's the ability to. So then it feels like, why wouldn't we just cherry pick what's the best for us, and when we want to change it, we change it.
Yeah, I probably wasn't clear enough. My take on the restack is that in the future, when another need arises, and the commission in North Dakota makes its decision through the restack as to what the best resource is to meet that need, that doesn't change. That particular selection is there, just like the plant got built that the resource or that the commission decided on. So we're not saying that you got backsies. I think that's how we've referred to it. You don't get that option to, oh my gosh, we shouldn't have done that. So I guess therein the commission now does put itself in a little more of the driver's seat, and that may or may not result in the end in lower costs, as I indicated earlier. Because now there's a short term and there's a long term aspect, mm-hmm. and there's this whole looking out into the future and trying to guess everything that's mm-hmm. going to happen.
So to use a real example, if you come forward with a solar project, we say no, we want no part of solar. We replace whatever that is with a comparable, the proxy. And then over time, the solar turns out to be a really good deal and the proxy is far more expensive. We're stuck with the proxy.
Yes. If that's a solar contract, for the life of that contract, it'll be priced at whatever the selection was that it should be priced at. So if that proxy ends up being something that's variable, if it's somehow tied to the market or mm-hmm. some other, and those prices go up, then yeah, that's still going to be the price.
Okay.
That energy will be delivered at.
Okay, that helps me better understand that. Thank you. If we could go to the revenues for a minute and sort of dig in a little bit more from Mr. Sparby's testimony. On page 17 of your submitted testimony, there's the chart, the bar graphs there, and it shows the 5550 and the, you know, obviously the you don't earn your ROE on year 2016. Now, you guys, you stated earlier that the revenue needs decline in 2016. So, and I'm trying to think of like 2016 and then moving beyond that, there's this inability to earn your ROE. But if your revenue needs have declined in 2016, why can't you earn your ROE?
Well, actually, I believe I may have stated that our capital expenditures and our investment cycle declines dramatically in 2016. Keep in mind, every time we spend a dollar of investment, it generates costs for the next, you know, 30 to 40 years. As we depreciate it, as it generates property taxes, as it requires a return on the investment, it's there. So, you know, there are still upward revenue requirement pressures even from the investments that we're making today. In fact, even part of this present case is being impacted by investments that were made in maybe late 2012 that weren't fully reflected in the last case. So you just have to keep in mind that it's not a year-by-year thing where you spend a dollar, you recover it. No, it builds and builds, and so investment drives a lot of other different revenue requirement costs.
So there's going to be sort of an
so there is
shortfall in
2016, I'm sure if we looked at the revenue requirements, they would be higher than 2015. The previous three-year increases do, you know, stay with us, but they're just not sufficient to carry 2016. But the real problem in 2016 is that we're modeling that we have not recovered the part of the restack from other jurisdictions. So we are just flat out that recovery, and that's the millions of dollars we talked about before. So that's the major driver in 2016. If we can solve that problem, then the 2016 bar goes closer to the authorized level.
Okay.
It's a very significant incentive for the company to address that part of the restack provision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Then I think I'd like to move into the allocation factor study. Okay. On page 31 and 32, you cover that in your testimony. When I look at, on page 32, what will be the criteria to analyze the various methods? You talk about fairness. Any demand allocator should be fairly apportioned, should fairly apportion costs based on the cost causation principle, the key goal of setting the demand allocator. So that tells me, yes, that is going to address North Dakota's big issue is, are we unfairly paying for costs that aren't causing? That's our big concern. When you get into, so I'm curious how in this study you're going to evaluate, get at what are the costs that North Dakota customers are creating and causing? How can we get at that in the study?
Well, we get some people in the room that have worked with this stuff for a long time, and we sprinkle a few of us other people, Mr. Diller and myself, and we get the input of other parties to get their perspective, and we probably initially learn from each other a lot and try to understand the different perspectives and, if possible, pull it all together into some level of consensus. I guess I'm not fond of that word, but some level of agreement that, yeah, that's really what we need to look for. That's what we need to focus on. And so I think doing a review of a number of different allocators based on some of those principles or discussions that we have at the front end should get us pretty close. And you're right, the cost causation is, again, going back to the perfect world analogy, that would be the only consideration. What is the absolute purest allocator, depending on who's driving the costs? But unfortunately, it's not a perfect world, and we all need to get along. And perhaps more importantly, the North Dakota Commission should not lose sight that it's very important for electric service in North Dakota to have a healthy utility. And having a healthy utility is a utility that is able to recover 100% of its allocated costs. So the issue of consistency that's on here is not just simply a convenience thing. It gets to the core of what the allocator needs to do so that, you know, service can be rendered safely and reliably.
Do you envision going sort of digging down to the level of sort of looking at the various peaks, what facilities are running during those peaks, and how much North Dakota is using during the peaks, like what our percentage of the peak is, and kind of digging way down into kind of like a one-by-one? Or is this going to be more of a theoretical, like, here's this formula, plug all the numbers in, here's what we get, here's this one, plug all the numbers in?
Well, that discussion I was talking about earlier is where we avoid getting too academic about it, that we make sure we've got a sound footing, a reasoned footing for selecting certain allocators. And one thing that, you know, I've been looking at demand allocator for North Dakota for literally 20 years because it's kind of my job to understand what our earnings are in the state and ensure that we're getting cost recovery, and the allocator has been a big deal forever. So I've been watching that and learning, and the way that I have come to understand this demand allocation is that it's just not true that we plan our system to meet one peak. It's just not true. And if it was true, our system would only have a big collection of peaking plants, because it costs a lot less to build a peaking plant than it does to build a base load or even an intermediate plant. So the fact that we have good base load plants on our system is proof positive that we don't plan only for the peak. We also plan, there's another criteria, and it was clearly stated in Mr. Brockett's direct testimony. The other consideration, besides meeting that peak, which is sort of the reliability side, the other consideration is, what is the absolute least cost that we can generate power throughout the whole year? And that's where base load plants and intermediate plants come into play, because, you know, they're $2,000 to $3,000 per kilowatt to build, versus $700 for a peaking plant. So how do you justify putting a plant in place that costs $3,000 a kilowatt when you could have done it for $600 or $700? Well, the reason is because it's working 24/7, and thereby those costs are being spread, and in the end you're actually better off. So there's just, in my mind, there's no way that an allocator for all of these costs, base load, intermediate, peaking, can possibly look at only 1 hour in the year. It's just not the way it works. So in my mind, we will look at the 1 CP. We will probably look at a 3 CP. We will look at peaking methods. But I'm just, the way I understand it and the way that I'm comfortable with the 12 CP is that it does recognize both elements of how we plan the system and how North Dakota contributes to the system needs. Quite frankly, yes, North Dakota does not contribute as much to the peak, but North Dakota contributes a lot more to the other non-peak energy use than you would think. So it only makes sense then that North Dakota would pay a little bit more for the fixed costs that are related to cheaper energy than they might pay for the fixed costs related to meeting that single peak. And that's what this all boils down to. So we'll look at everything, but I just think the way this thing will work out is the more refined way to allocate these costs is to look at breaking your generating costs into the peak piece and the energy piece. And once we go there, the 12 CP is a very reasonable proxy. And quite frankly, if you were to do it as pure as possible and segregate the energy piece and allocate it on energy and segregate the peak piece and allocate it on the 1 CP, you'd probably end up with a combined allocator that would be higher for North Dakota than the 12 CP. So I'm just very comfortable that the 12 CP is a great proxy. I don't want to foreclose on the outcome of the study. Mike and I have talked about this. You know, this is an opportunity for this study to actually lead and for the North Dakota Commission to say it's time to do a study. We do the study and we go to the other state jurisdictions and we say, look what we found. Look what this analysis came up with. It makes sense, doesn't it? Well, in fact, you were involved, so you know it makes sense. I mean, it's a chance to lead rather than North Dakota just sort of accepting policy. Now North Dakota is leading with an effort to try to make it right. So I guess maybe if that's too optimistic, that's the way it is. But I think it could be a very productive and healthy process. I'm actually a little concerned that we've only given ourselves 6 months to do it, but we'll do the best we can.
What I'm hearing a mutual goal. I would like to lead with a study that shows, you know, as true as we can, but what you kind of outlined sounded to me like you've already got it in your mind that it's the 12 CP.
I have it in my mind, but I'm only...
How do we get that out of the study? I mean, if you're leading it, how does the study not already bias in that direction?
Iron sharpens iron. I am not so naive to think that I am the be-all, end-all for the demand allocator. So I have a perspective. Mr. Diller has a perspective. We come together, and as reasonable people, we learn new perspectives. And I had never thought of that. And we go through that process, and we do study it all. I'm just telling you. Maybe I shouldn't be. I'm just telling you what my understanding is, and after years of struggling at times with this, and wondering is this the right thing to do, and and then kind of going on that journey that maybe you're going on now. This is where I'm at, but that doesn't mean that that's the way the study will work. I am not going to run the study. I'm not going to.
Well, and that's what I mean, I think the study, I'm very comfortable with the study as a process. It's a big issue. It needs to be done right. I recognize the importance of not leaving you guys with a bunch of stranded investments that you can't recover, and how that would put you in a bad position and threaten, the future reliability of service to our customers. I get that. But I want the study to be unbiased, and I'm not comfortable that the settlement agreement is clear enough on the methodology and how we're going to get at that unbiased study that isn't just kind of the company running things through a bunch of different formulas and producing what you kind of wanted to, which is the 12CP. So that's my concern.
We would certainly be willing to strengthen the language around that process to ensure that it includes, as I mentioned before, other state agencies, other utility companies, and perhaps even a consultant if there's some interest in that. And quite frankly, Commissioner, I believe that the commission would be driving this study because we would be touching base with you and saying, here's where we're at so far, here's what we've determined, and if the commission thinks that we're, you know, getting off the tracks or it's not making sense, that'll be the opportunity for you to make that known. So,
okay. All right, my final question, this is more general, and it's something I asked Zev in the informal, or he responded, but tell me, what were the company's greatest gives in this settlement?
Greatest gives, man, I had a great little list here, if I could pull it up. No, as I look back on the settlement, I mean, it's clear in my mind that the primary benefit to the company is the opportunity to recover these costs that are going to be there. They're going to be there. They're legitimate, prudent costs, and, you know, it's the cost of being a good company that provides good, reliable service. So that's our big WIFM, if you will. You know, there's the other sort of smaller benefits that are sort of mutual. I mean, avoiding filing rate cases is exhausting and not always very productive, quite frankly. Hate to point to this case, but, I mean, wow. So those are the things that we kind of get out of it. I would almost suggest that every other provision in the settlement is a concession on our part, whether it's, you know, earnings sharing, the historically low ROE, the restack, the loss of recovery potential there, huge. The commitment to build generation, you know, we want to build generation in North Dakota, but quite frankly, a commitment like that does limit you a little bit. Now, that's a consideration. It's a bit of a concession. The longer amortization of the non-recurring expenses, the rate cases, those adjustments, we conceded all of the staff position on those expense adjustments. Developing a robust time of day rate, something that staff has wanted to do, we're willing to come alongside there. Passing back 100% of rec sales now instead of 90, passing back 100% of wholesale margin proceeds instead of 85. We're going to have to go through and do a better job on our tariff book, quite frankly. That's a lot of work, but it's, you know, it's good work. We have to improve our jurisdictional test year reporting, so when we're in the midst of a case and you guys ask for an update with this month's data, we can turn around and do that. So there's a lot of things in here, it's a big honey-do list, a lot of check marks, but the big item for us is the ability to get through the next 4 years with a rate plan. And you know, this, if you look at it, the settlements, the rate plan is more than the 5550. I mean, the rate plan encompasses a number of things. It's the riders, it's the rate plan, it's even the restack affects the rates, or could or will in 2016. So it's a package of rate mechanisms, if you will, the 50-50 sharings, another rate impacting provision. But it's a package that gets us through the next 4 years without spending $500,000 or $600,000 on per rate case. I mean, That's just not that, you know, that's not that efficient. I shouldn't diss the traditional regulatory process, but you know, the world's changing fast and maybe too fast sometimes for some of the ways that we're used to doing things. And so it's my two cents on that.
Okay. I'm going to ask one more question, but so the original, I forget what the original rate increase was, request was almost
17 million.
But the percentage?
9.25.
And now you're accepting with this settlement 5% for 2013. How does the company manage that?
Yes. Don't forget, the 5% relates to the base rate. Another provision, and it's sort of a creative way to bridge this gap that you've just brought up, but we have about $10 million of Department of Energy proceeds that we won because of a litigation around their inability to accept spent fuel. We credited customers with about half of it in the last case, and what we're proposing in this case is using the other half to buy down those base rate increases. So the company would retain the remaining half of those, reduce the base rate increase, which is good because you don't want to bake in a higher increase. It's there forever then, so it helps customers. And that's how we bridge that gap for that first year.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dave.
Commissioners, I'd like to break for lunch about now. Do you want to, would that be okay and come back and ask your questions, Mr. Cedarquist?
You know, Judge, I got one question.
Okay.
So we can at least move it on down the road a little bit.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just one question. What's the interconnection update with Border Winds? Do you know that, Dave?
I don't, but
okay, that's
Mr.
fine.
Wisher,
okay,
could address that.
And that was the only. That's fine.
Well, just say I'm hearing good things. I'm hearing good things, encouraging.
And my one comment is about the gas plant. I've talked before about you guys buy your power to serve mine it. You could build a big natural gas plant up and mine it too, and you could sell a whole bunch to Basin Electric and to MDU. So there's all these opportunities to build stuff in North Dakota if you just reach out and do it. You guys build a big 250-megawatt gas plant, you could use it forever and make a whole bunch of money selling it.
Yeah, again, I think the settlement's the beginning of a future that's more, be more like that. So,
thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Christman, anything before lunch?
I can wait, it's only a few. It's up to you, I guess.
Let's break now. I know some of the attorneys want to get to the Big Muddy Park and fire lunch,
okay.
And there's a vote there today that's important to some people, so... why don't we come back at 1:15? It should give us plenty of time. Thank you all. Off the record.
Good, thanks.